Namaste, good morning. Someone asked a wise sage, what is more important, the journey or the destination? What is more important, the journey or the destination? And he replied, the company, sangh, sangat. In the Sikh and Punjabi community, the word is sangat, association. While on this journey of life, who are we associated with and what are we associated with? Who is simple, and what includes our beliefs, our concepts, our thoughts, and all that is the content of our minds. Because whatever is occupying our consciousness is what we are associated with. So simple. Now, most of this association is unrecognized, unconscious, because words have taken over the dynamics and the conditioning the words carry. If you look at your friends, your own circle of friends, you will know without words which friends resonate more with you and which don't resonate as much. It is a feeling in silence. The association is prior to words. For example, if you meet someone at a party or at an event and you are introduced to that person, till that point, the universe has brought two individuals together. And then the introductions happen, you find out more about the other through words, and then some relationships get established, others don't. But the silent force which brings two people together, and that meeting could not have happened without them coming together, through no plan of theirs, through no will of theirs, that force is not recognized. And that same force does not leave the picture once the association happens. It is always there. It is there now. But in the world of words and labels and names, that goes unrecognized. That is the great architect of the universe, forging relationships and associations beyond our comprehension. And then comes the association, with a teaching, with perhaps a teacher, with a school of thought, whatever you call it. And that association starts shining light on one's journey. And that is the company. So in that sense, the journey as well as the destination lose their significance because one is now immersed in association. There is quite a popular story many in India have heard about the Rishi Narad, the most accomplished of sages. And he went to Lord Vishnu, the sustainer of the universe, one day. And he said, "Lord, can you explain to me this meaning of Sangat?" So Vishnu was surprised. He said, "Someone as great as you is asking such a question." He said, "Yes, because when I go down to the worldly plane, I get lost in all these words and meanings and labels, and I'm not able to understand the benefit to the human race." So Vishnu kept quiet. He said, "I can't yet figure how someone as exalted as you does not know this. But anyway, you go down to earth, you will come across a crow, and you ask the crow, what is the meaning of Sangat?" Narad was quite taken aback. So he went down, found himself in a forest, and almost immediately came across one crow sitting on a branch. And he did a namaste, and he asked the crow, "Please tell me, what is the meaning of Sangat?" And the crow fell dead, fell off the branch and fell at his feet. And he was surprised, he was shocked, he was aghast. So he quickly ran up to Vishnu and said, "My God, what has happened? I asked the question you asked me to ask, and this is what has happened." So Vishnu said, "Don't worry. These things happen. You go back down, and you will come across a very wise parent that has been around for a long time on the planet, and you ask the same question." So Narad had to obey Vishnu's command. So he went back down, and sure enough, he saw a parrot, a majestic, huge parrot. Now, when he was before the parrot, he said, "I better be careful." He waited a couple of minutes, composed himself, and did namaste to the parrot and said, "I have a question to ask. What is the meaning of Sangat and Satsang?" And the parrot looked into his eyes and fell dead. And Narad was most upset that this has happened twice. Such a sincere question has got this kind of an answer. So he went back to Vishnu and said, "What is this? I can't bear it anymore." And Vishnu said, "Don't worry. Go back down. And this time, you will come across a horse amongst many horses, but with your discernment, you will know which horse I am referring to. And when you come across that horse, you ask the horse this question. And this time, Narad was a bit fearful. But he still went down and he was walking a bit and he came across a group of horses which were being tended to by some people. And one horse stood out, the one that looked most majestic. And he said, now I'm in a fix, because if I ask this question in front of the other horses, and the horse dies, I'll be in big trouble. So he waited and waited. He kept looking at that one horse. Then the horses were led to their stables. And he followed this horse. At night, he went into the stable, looked for a long time at the horse. And the horse, being an intelligent one, looked at Narad. And this went on for quite some time. And then when Narad had the confidence, he asked the horse, can you tell me the meaning of Sangat? And the horse collapsed and died. And Narad could not bear this anymore. That through the words that came out of his mouth, these majestic beings are dying. So he went and complained to Vishnu. He said, this is not on. This can't be happening. Such an innocent question is met with this kind of response. And Vishnu said, go back down. You will come across a young boy. You ask him this question. Narad said, nothing doing. I know what's going to happen. He said, no, trust me. Go back down. The boy will be born to a royal family. Go and ask this question. So Narad went down, found out a birth had taken place in a royal family. Now this time he was wiser. He decided to build a hut outside the palace. And he said to himself, I will wait till this boy grows up to be a prince. I don't want to risk asking this question yet. I will wait. I will watch in silence. And then I will, at the right time, ask the question. So the years rolled by and Narad had one pointed attention. His focus was on this child. And as the child grew, the child noticed Narad and he would ask the guards, who is this sage who has built a small hut outside the palace and he keeps looking at me with such benevolent eyes? Such softness, such gentleness. And the guard said, we don't know, but he has been there since you were born. And then the young prince asked his guards to call him in. And he asked him, he said, why have you been looking for me, looking at me, waiting for me? What is it that you have to say? And Narad said, I can't get myself to say it. I'm very sorry. And the prince said, but all these years, I felt such tenderness coming from you. Waves of peace and compassion. So please tell me, what brings you here? Why have you done this for so many years? And I can't get myself to say it because the consequences will be too much to bear for me. And the prince told Narad, I will ask your question. So Narad was surprised. He said, your question is, what is the meaning of Sangat? Narad was taken aback. How did the prince know this? And he said, don't worry, I will not drop dead. And then the prince told Narad, Narad, I guess you had to come to earth to learn this lesson. Someone of your caliber. I was the crow. I was the parrot. I was the horse. And I am the prince. And with association with you, which was for a fraction of a few minutes as the crow, got a bit longer because when I was the parrot, my association with you was more than the crow because you contemplated before asking the question, but I was in your presence as the parrot. And as the horse, you were in my consciousness for an even longer time because you hesitated a lot. But your mere presence, my association in each of these successive births with you enabled me to evolve to this form as the prince. And then since my birth, I have had association with you since that time till now. And so, words are not required, Narad. You asked a question up in the heavens, but this is the land of words. And so I have given you the answer in words. But your mere presence is the association. It is the silence before words. That is your gift to humanity. Words come afterwards. And the more the association with you, the more the evolution of the soul. And therefore, I have gained in understanding as this prince because I saw all qualities emanating from you without words over these years. And finally, the prince said, and Narad, as you must have guessed, I, Vishnu, was the crow, was the parrot, was the horse, and am the prince. So even someone like Narad could not fathom in words, what is this association? And then he realized, it is the association of presence. The association of presence prior to words. Sat Sang. Meeting in truth. All your meetings are in silence. I would like to read out two passages from the Egyptian Book of the Dead. It is a commentary on the Egyptian Book of the Dead. We have to watch our feelings because they will change to be thoughts. Our thoughts will become actions. Our actions will become habits. And our habits will become our destiny. We have to watch our feelings because they will change to be thoughts. Our thoughts will become actions. Our actions will become habits, and our habits will become our destiny. Now, what happens when one comes across a teaching, three things can happen. One, you resonate with it completely because you feel it validates your life's experience. Two, some of it resonates with you, some doesn't. Some of it makes sense, some does not make sense. But you keep thinking about it. And three, it disturbs you when you come across a teaching. It disturbs you tremendously. You can't believe what you have heard or read. Yet, you keep thinking about it. Now, there's one thing common in all these three. It is the teaching that has now occupied the mind space. And one is constantly thinking about it. Everything in life is now viewed through the prism of the teaching. And then parts are accepted. Sometimes the whole is accepted. Sometimes the whole is rejected. Yet there is a pull. So you're constantly thinking about it. So that becomes the association with the teaching. And that is why Maharaj had once said, when a seeker had walked in through the door, sat down for a few minutes, started listening to what was being said, and then got up and left. And after he left, Maharaj told his satsang, "It's too late. The sheer fact that he walked in here and sat for a few minutes means sufficient time was given for the seed to be planted. Now, when that seed will sprout is God's will." So what happens is when you start looking at your relationships in a different light, compared to earlier, you start looking at people differently. What is happening? The old patterns are now changing. The old grooves one was stuck in based on accusations, based on doership, are getting redefined. The fresh conditioning brought in by the teaching is rewiring one's understanding about life and relationships. So let's say where you were harboring a grudge in the past, now with the understanding, it is a superficial grudge, or let's say you don't hold on to the grudge, or there is no feeling of grudge. So it is the teaching that is bringing one forth to one's destiny, which is peace of mind. I will read out something more. In the triangle of earth, the person must first achieve awakening, which can be achieved by the presence of a teacher or a master, where the individual can ask questions and they will be answered. It can also be acquired by persistence and discipline in applying what the master has instructed, and by vanquishing the possessive nature of the individual's psyche. For example, a farmer should give the first crop of his land, and an employee should offer his or her first month's salary for God's sake. By vanquishing their acquisitive nature, human beings are able to suspend the physical illusion, and this enables them ultimately to see their true nature and their real lives. Awakening can also be acquired by traumas and disasters which act as teachers. For example, people may abuse their body until they have a heart attack, but it is this heart condition that will force them afterwards to eat correctly, exercise, and offer prayers of thanks. In this instance, the sickness becomes a blessing, and so we should seek to gain at least one lesson from any problem. You see, this is pointing to this acquisitive nature is not just material objects, but all our identifications in life, what we are identified with and what we derive our sense of self from. This is me and my story. And when that is under threat, I get upset. Therefore, whatever upsets you is your teacher. And you will be quite surprised at the volume of thoughts of upset that are based on the fact that I think someone did something to me or I did something to someone. Then you start letting go of such thought processes. The acquisitive nature starts loosening up. It is the me that acquires to define itself and then to project through that definition. This is me. This is what I stand for. This is who I am. This need starts getting diminished for a spiritual seeker. Then you become like the Buddha. One day was walking past some people and they were abusing him. And he said, "Please excuse me, I have an errand to run. When I come back, you can continue abusing me." Because it made no difference. Do you know the symbol of surrender? When we see the cops and robbers, the hands up symbol, we owe that to the Egyptians. The modern interpretation is, oh, I can see your hands, so you can't do anything to me. Fair enough. The Egyptian symbol was like this, which meant above the mind. Above the mind. It is not a mental process to surrender. Many on the spiritual path say, "I have surrendered." Even those not on the spiritual path say, "Oh, I decided to surrender. I couldn't do anything about it, so I decided to surrender." It is the situation that forced you to surrender, you see. Surrender happens when you accept that very little is in your control. As we can see today with what's going on, very little is in our control. And surrender happens. Surrender to that force that operates in silence prior to words. To bring about what is meant to be brought about. To say, "I surrender," is the ego coming in through the back door. Because now it implies I have a choice whether to surrender or not, and so I choose to surrender. Surrender is a tricky thing. Someone had sent me an email saying they follow Shirdi Sai Baba and consider him their guru. And they feel there is no need to have a physical guru in this life because the surrender is complete. And most certainly, if surrender is complete, where is the need for someone to surrender to? But then, the issue was, they are struggling financially. Relationships are in a mess between the husband and wife. Pray fervently to Sai Baba. Have full faith and trust in him. But the situation is getting from bad to worse. And why isn't Sai Baba hearing their prayers? Poor Sai Baba. This is surrender. Surrender to an outcome that you want. So you are fully surrendered and you've struck a bargain with Sai Baba. Total faith in God, in your master, means no matter what happens, you know that it is his will with a capital H. That is surrender. That is why Osho said that it's a game of deception. When people say they are surrendered to God, they are fooling themselves most of the times. It is far difficult to surrender to another being as a spiritual master, teacher. All the spiritual traditions, Zen, Greek philosophy, Hinduism. Why is the master-teacher, master-disciple relationship the most sacred? Because when you are surrendering to another being, that is when the ego shatters, as Osho has said. Sai Baba himself had two gurus, Venkusa and Zarzari Zarbaksh. Ramana Maharshi took Arunachala as his guru, the hill. And after all, the guru is your own higher self. If you tell someone that, they don't hesitate to surrender to their higher self. But they still think of the person as separate. How can I let go? How can I hand over my will to someone else? You are handing it over to your higher self. That is surrender. Surrender to God is surrender to what is, not what should be. Because then we are already assuming that things are not right the way they are and they should be another way. So ours is a partial surrender. One hand is up and the other is in our pocket. All right. Take a couple of questions, if there are any. Yes, Rahul.
Good morning, Gautam. How are you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I actually missed the last few Sunday meetings, and I feel really bad about it. But it's so great to be a part of it today. My question is related to your book, Pointers by Ramesh Balsekar.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if this pointers is pointing to the impersonal consciousness that Ramesh ji keeps talking about in his lectures. Also pointers by Nisargadatta Maharaj, for example. Is it this impersonal consciousness that he's referring to?
Rahul, it is pointing to consciousness. Consciousness, as he would say, is all there is. Consciousness, impersonal consciousness and identified consciousness. In the deep sleep state, it is impersonal because you don't know that you exist in deep sleep. And in the waking state, that impersonal becomes identified with a name and form. Even in the dream state, there's identification. So they are two sides of the same coin. So the pointing is to consciousness, the truth, you could say. So the illusion, which is the illusion of doership, the dream of doership, in practical daily living, where we used to point at individuals, as he did this and he said this, when the understanding dawns that consciousness is all there is, because without consciousness, this conversation wouldn't be happening. Consciousness is speaking through one body and listening to the other. All there is consciousness. So in that sense, it becomes impersonal because the person is no longer targeted as an individual based on something they have done. So you are right, quite right in that sense. It is pointing to impersonality as a way of understanding. Because let's not forget that in life, in manifestation, in daily living, we are individuals with our separate characteristics. But now we no longer target individuals with our guns. That is what happens.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Welcome. Yes, sir, Shibashish.
Hello, sir. This is my first time here. I'm so... I would take a bit of time to tell you how I'm feeling because I've never been a part of a satsang before. And it's relatively new to this. Can you hear me, by the way? Again, this is the first time, so I...
I can hear you, I can see you, and I can see some musical instrument music.
Right. This is... I make music for a living, so this is...
Oh, lovely. Yeah.
I'm so glad to be here and just to hear you speak. It's quite strange because, like I said, I've recently met you online. Not that you know that. I have come across your foreword on Eckhart's book and I read it twice. First, when I bought the book and after 2 months of rereading it, and I went back to the foreword and I remember how you wrote it, that when you were departing and he said that we aren't going anywhere. We just, yeah, and I will sound extremely confused and incomprehensible in a lot of ways because I do a bit of reading, but I also think that it's just my analytical mind that comes up with these questions, and I try to not engage with all of that, but I don't think I am successful that way. And to hear you speak about Narada and Vishnu, the act of surrender, and it's so insightful, and so forgive me that I raised a hand, because when you said that story about the act of surrendering with all your heart and all your being, I make music for a living, and this, in some people would say that's the show business, or the world of forms and names and labels, and I have to engage in that format. Because some say that you have to build an audience, you need to do that. And I'll be very honest, when they say that or ask me in interviews, I keep saying I don't know how to do it. Whatever little that has happened very organically, but it almost takes a very compulsive structure because there are conflicts of beliefs. And especially when there are producers involved, they want you to work not only on the basis of working, but also on the basis of belief that if I pay you, we have to work, be on the same page. You have to sell this. You need to sell tickets to the show. And so I keep thinking that, but I don't think that's how it's supposed to be. Now, I can't say that again, because that itself is a compulsion. So I was simply thinking if you could maybe point to how to strike a balance, because I came across your video where you speak about the the free will, and how you spoke about free will and how everything is predestined. And surprisingly, for the first time, I come from a Bengali background, and if nobody here is a Bengali, I must tell everybody, and even you, that people here keep blaming their their kopal. In Bangla, it's called kopal, means your destiny. And from childhood, they keep saying, I couldn't do this because it was not in my destiny. So whenever I heard that, I always felt, no, I don't want to feel that way. For the first time, when you said that, I was like, but that teaching gave me a sense of relief, because I felt, so if everything is destined, I can just simply be. Even after knowing that, I think it was just an intellectual translation in my mind, because if it was a real realization, I wouldn't be asking this question. And yet I'm here asking you, could you tell me, how would you advise a bit of balance, where I have to engage in the world of forms for perhaps a bit of money to just live, but and sometimes fame works in mysterious ways, and it is always projected in your childhood, from each other, that you have to be, if you are successful, that must mean that you are very popular. And I don't know how to shake that feeling and just make music because I want to. I'm still doing it, but that thought is there. It beats me up sometimes. It tells me you're not doing enough. So I'm sorry if this is an imposition,
maybe next time we'll be fortunate enough to hear some of your music.
Sure, I would love that.
And you see, we live in a society, so the middle way is the path to walk on. If we were isolated in caves, we can have all these concepts and not give a damn about people earning money and so on. But we are living in a society, we have to earn our money, and therefore it is prudent to walk the middle path. And the teaching is such a tremendous gift, because all that you have said right now is because you already have this understanding, what is really of true value, what is not of true value. Yet you have to deal with producers, you have to deal with business environment. Sometimes you have to swallow your pride, so to speak, if you know you're getting your next check, which you need to survive on. But the whole beauty of it is that with the understanding, the blame game is over. You're not blaming the producer, you're not blaming your destiny, you're not blaming situations, you're not condemning people, you're not hating yourself. So in that sense, the game becomes lighter, because you're not back home with this whole baggage on your shoulders of how people should behave and should not behave. How dare they behave like this because they are paying me, so they want me to change my tunes for that. See, that dialogue is finished, because the understanding of life has happened. Sometimes it is a process. The frustrations are bound to arise at work especially, but the involvement in that frustration gets considerably reduced, and one finds oneself more and more at peace with what is happening. And I'm saying this from my own experience, because I started work at the age of 20. And so I have a good number of years behind me where I had to deal with, firstly, when I started work, I was the youngest in my office of 30 people. So nobody really took me seriously, but yet I was in charge of them. So it was quite funny. But dealing with clients, dealing with suppliers, dealing with colleagues, that is why when Rameshji said life is about relationships, it struck me that that is the reality of my life, because my work was my life at that age, and everything was relationships. The supplier who printed he did a miserable job of printing was a relationship. The client who didn't pay us for 3 months was a relationship. The colleague who was not performing the way they should be performing is a relationship. So that's why I kind of marinated in this teaching so easily, because I could see that life was about relationships. And so in fact, someone like you or anyone listening to this who is immersed in a work environment the teaching comes to the fore because you can see it in action. That is the beauty of it. So this is the middle way. I think the teaching is what helps, enables one to walk on the middle path. Okay?
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Thank you so much.
All the best for your music and for your relationship with your producer.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. I think that's it for now. We have Laura here. Yes, Laura.
Namaste, Gautam.
Namaste.
I would like to thank you for publishing In Love with the Divine Mother.
Uh-huh.
Such an exquisite book. And thank you for introducing me to her. She's become such an important part of my life.
This is the first book you have read on her life, Anandmayi Maa's life?
Well, while I was waiting for that one to arrive from India, I bought a couple others and now I have many.
Okay.
So I've been reading many. I even found some that are direct translations, like of her letters and things like that.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's wonderful.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you.
For those who are not too familiar with Anandmayi Maa, she was a spiritual luminary. I mean, even that is not sufficient. Because from birth, she was, as someone asked her, who are you? And she said, Purna Brahma Narayan, I am the all-pervading reality. And so there are many books on her teachings. And we recently published one big one, large format one in color. You see, she was even the most spiritually beautiful being, I would say, if you see her photographs, especially those where she is lost in a trance or samadhi or whatever you call it, it's radiant spiritual beauty. And that's what I mean. As you know, as I keep referring to the Buddhists who say that when you meet someone, before they talk and you can hear their words, you see their face. And the face reveals all. And so that is why in India we have a tradition of keeping photographs of spiritual masters and teachers, because it's just the photo, it is the visual imprint, because all they embody is on the face. And so others who might want to know more about Anandmayi Maa, most beautiful short biography we had published called A Goddess Among Us. I think you will finish it in half an hour to 40 minutes. It's that short, but it's beautiful. It's written by a direct disciple of hers. You'll find it online. And the book Laura is referring to is the journey of someone who was associated with Ma from a young age, as a young girl. And she is narrating her story of her experiences with Anandmayi Maa. And then she grows up to be a Bollywood star in the heydays of Bollywood. Then she gives that up and becomes a follower of Ma and becomes a Swamini, celibate, and follows initiation Diksha procedures with Anandmayi Maa. And its most beautiful revelations written by Swamini Nityanand Giri, who lives not even a 5-minute walk away from me on Marine Drive. It took Anandmayi Maa to bring us together. We didn't know each other. And that is how grace works. And it's a real fabulous tribute to Anandmayi Maa. All right. Thank you, Laura. You gave me the opportunity to spread her word. Yes, Harish.
Hi, Gautamji, how are you? Good morning.
Good, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Gautamji, I wanted to ask you, though I have been following up a lot of your videos and your channels, I am very confused and, you know, I misinterpret the concept of consciousness and the source, which you keep explaining that it is the consciousness when it's God's will and it is the source and it's not a person or a form and a body that we look up to. And like in Sai Satcharita also, it's been explained that whatever happens, and if anything has to happen, not even a leaf can shake or move if it's not up to the divine or, you know, up to his doing. So when I have to, you know, perceive or understand whatever has happened is due to God's will, and the consciousness means awareness. So whom am I looking up to exactly? Is it the universe we are talking about here, or what exactly is this? I'm just confused with that concept.
See, Harish, it's actually the same thing. So even if it helps you to think of a form of God, like it could be Shiva, it could be Sai Baba, whatever, it's irrelevant because that is the form the formless has taken. So if you are comfortable with that, then forget about the source and consciousness. You see, because we, being embodied, relate more easily to someone embodied, to God as an embodied form. That is the bhakti part. You know, singing and chanting bhajans in praise of the Lord. In bhakti, it could be Krishna, it could be anyone, because that is what we are familiar with. So don't get lost in these concepts. In Jnana Yoga, on the path of non-duality, Advaita, what we are showing is something very simple, that there is something unseen which makes us speak and listen and act. That something unseen is not a form. It is consciousness. It is the source. That is how we refer to it. But please don't get stuck on all this, because then the point will be missed. The point is, what gives you peace of mind in daily living? So if you prefer having the form of your guru or the form of God to think of as the source, as consciousness, please be comfortable in that. This is not a kind of trying to adjust to something else, trying to understand it. Whatever resonates with you, please stay with that. What we are trying to point at is not my will, but thy will. Now that thy, for some, they can understand is impersonal consciousness, is the source. Others may say, no, let thy be Jesus, let it be Sai Baba or whoever. So whatever you're comfortable with, because we don't want to create more discomfort on this journey. It is the understanding which impacts daily living, which is being offered. So please forget about not understanding all these nuances and, you know, finer points. Let it be.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. Do we have time or are we done? Maybe one more question. I think Laura's hand is still up. Is it by mistake or is it by... It's a mistake. No, it's not. Yes, Laura, good to have you back.
Namaste. I actually did have a question that I wanted to ask.
Okay, sorry.
No, that's fine. I would like to understand the nature of God's will. And all of existence continuously unfolds like a fractal emerging out of its source code.
Yes.
So God's will infused that source code, and it must also be expressed at each present moment.
Yes.
So the fact that not a leaf falls without his knowing must be a combination of the life pattern that was willed at the birth of the universe,
yes,
along with the will that is expressed just at the moment that the leaf attains the capacity to detach from the stem. So that would mean that God's will is both determined or fixed and dynamic or changing in time. Could you talk about that?
Yes, the answer is yes, yes, and yes. You know, it reminds me, once I was in a plane, I was going to fly from Pune to Bombay, which is a very short half an hour flight, and the flight got canceled. And so we shared a taxi, me and a German couple shared a taxi because we had to reach Bombay in a hurry. And the taxi driver was like a speed demon. He was like zipping on the highway, and the lanes are pretty much undefined. This is going back 15 years. So you can be on either side of the road depending on where the traffic is. So the German man got very worked up. And in English, he asked the taxi driver in frustration, "Are you driving on the left side of the road or the right side of the road?" And the taxi driver smiled. I could see it in the rearview mirror. And he said, "Yes." The thing is, in fact, someone asked me this question on email, and the reply I gave is, as Rameshji would say, manifestation is a block. It's like a block. What happens is that the individual starts slicing that block in the duration of time. So I give the example of a loaf of bread. Okay, the loaf is one singularity, one block. And now we have sliced it into past, present, and future. So there are slices we have had, the slice we are having, and the slices we will have, because our thought process is in the duration of time. But that block is all inclusive. It is already there. The other point is that who wants to know the nature of God's will? Who wants to know the nature of God's will? That itself is a created object, wanting to know the will of the creator subject. And therefore, as Rameshji would say, a painting can never know why its painter painted it. So, fragmentation of the source, the consciousness, happens as a will of the source of consciousness. The individual is not involved in it at all. And the journey back home to the source is when this fragmentation realizes itself to be fragmented and then starts healing back to the source, to the one and only. And so this whole journey, the entire journey, the entire cycle is actually the source itself assuming the role of the individual and asking this question about the nature of the source in order to discover itself. So will you get an answer? No, because the one who wants the answer is the ego, which is the thinking mind. What will happen is when you see your own life unraveling before you as this play of consciousness, this wanting to know starts dissolving and dissolving and dissolving and dissolving. Because you see the vast interconnectedness of the very next moment and what transpires in your life as soon as you get up from where you're sitting. And that is the whole manifestation, which has emerged as a reflection in the source, not of the source. Because if it is a reflection of the source, then there are two. It is a reflection within the source. And so the person, the individual asking this question, finds that the need to ask this question starts evaporating, starts dissolving, because it is already resting in the source. I hope that's not too abstract. Yeah. But the answer will never be given in words because of this. It will be known, it will be felt, and when you see in your own life that there's less and less of my will in operation and an acceptance of God's will, you then are already that. That's what happens.
Yes. I'm glad that you mentioned that one teaching from Ramishi, because I've been thinking about that for a while. Can the painting ever know why its painter painted it? Mm-hmm. But I would say yes, it can, because it has only to ask. And when it's ready, the painter will tell it.
Yeah. Then please let
Because everything is sentient. I mean, even minerals and mountains and everything has some kind of sentience.
Yes.
And so the answer may not come in words, but the answer could come if the painting asks, it's ready. Will it not get an answer?
The sentience will never ask the question. The sentience in the rocks and in the birds and wherever else has no need to ask that question because it does not consider itself separate. It is the human being which has been gifted the ego by the source, not the human being's doing, not the individual's doing. It is that which is asking the question. That is why I said it is the fragmentation of the source itself that asks itself this question, but the individual human being will not get the answer.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
We'll take one last one. Yes, Siddhant.
It's Shabnam.
Yes, Shabnam. I saw Siddhant's name on the.
Yeah, I use his laptop. Okay. So. Thank you so much. I think by the time, you know, your question is formed, so much of it is answered in the talk. Can you hear me? So much of it gets answered that, you know, I feel I have really nothing to say except thank you.
That's great.
However, I will still bring it up. Because, yeah, so what's happening is that, you know, since my association with you happened, the presence and, I mean, today's subject and topic was amazing. The satsang was really, really amazing. And so I feel there's a presence, right? Even, you know, online, well, now this is the format and I'm in your presence, you know, with the talk, and I'm in the presence of so many other teachers who I've been listening to, like Rameshji and David Gottman and, you know, Papaji, and, you know, on the same lines, because this is something very new and, like you said, abstract. It's very difficult because the conditioning has been in duality all this while, and a lot of it has in the past has been reactive, you know, like my associations, my relationships, I have been reactive, and therefore I wasn't really in the presence, you know, I was a very reactive person in the past. And of course, the analogy of the loaf of bread you gave is so soothing and comforting that, you know, this is the whole picture, and, you know, well, that was what was part of the entire whole and the entire creation.
Can't hear you now, Shabnam. Can you hold the...
Yeah. So it was about the part of the entire loaf, and that was also part of this entire creation, yeah. Right? I know everything, like we say, is the predetermined, preconditioned nature, you know, which is like if one has predominantly anger or predominantly, let's say, sadness, or predominantly any part which is more predominant in the nature. So how does one make this shift, you know, like from even through awareness, but how does the shift either do I have to wait that it'll happen for me and wait for the God's will, or is there something that I can also do about it? Like, let's say if I'm reactive, and you know, do I see less of that happening rather than in the past? Yeah, so my question is somewhere there.
Yes.
What is this role of the creation that has been created?
Yes.
To kind of on this aspect, yeah.
Yes, so Shabnam, the thing is that the effort is yours. Let's not make this mistake of thinking that there's nothing to be done, which is a common misconception on this path of Advaita non-duality. When Ramana Maharshi told people to follow the practice of self-inquiry, who am I? He meant to seriously follow it and ask this question. When whatever comes up, ask yourself, who am I? So the effort is the aspirants or the disciples. Now, let's take the example of anger. And one may be predisposed to anger. What does one do? You see, in that sense, what happens is that the understanding does the doing. But yet, in awareness, anger is seen as a biological reaction. And with the light of understanding, involvement in the anger or extension of the anger into being angry at someone, that starts dropping away. That is the difference the teaching makes. So let's say in the past, someone was volatile, angry all the time, angry with people, angry with life, angry with this and angry with that. One aspect is being predisposed to anger. That is just one aspect. It is not a license for being angry all the time, because after all, the harm is happening to you. So when these wisdom teachings come and they shine a light on this aspect, that, hey, look, if there is anger, look at it, find out for yourself why you got angry with this person, for example. You might conclude that it is based on something they did to you. And when you look at it in light of the teaching, you might see that it's really not their doing. And so the anger you were predisposed to stays just as a momentary pure anger and drops away, because the involvement in that anger in the horizontal time is no longer there thanks to the teaching. So there has to be a change, because if you are constantly involved in the anger like you were in the past, then that means this new teaching, which has brought about a new understanding, has not been able to penetrate into that involvement in the anger. So therefore, the teaching does the job. But understanding, being aware, that much openness, you could say, belongs to the disciple. Ultimately, you can say it's not even in their control, but the effort is still there. That is why someone like Nisargadatta Maharaj, he would also sit in meditation, not only himself, but he would allow people to sit with him as a practice. As a practice. And he would call meditation consciousness contemplating on itself, being aware of being, which we rarely do in our lives. In our daily living is full of our work, doing things. So we forget this focal point that we are aware. So that was the effort. So make no mistake that the teaching will do everything and you will transform. You as the individual have been brought to the teaching by the teaching, but your bit also has to be done, so to speak. It is not a separate component. And the test is in knowing, compared with 2 years ago or 2 months ago, where am I now in terms of peace of mind? That is the acid test. If you feel you are more at peace, no matter what, no matter the old habits, the old conditionings, the old patterns, but you feel deep down, you know, I'm at rest. Now, I see things differently. I react the same way because of years of conditioning, but then I see it and I find myself getting angry, but then I go and apologize to the person and say, hey, sorry, you know, I didn't mean it. So that can happen. So the test is, ask yourself, has my life, my outlook on life, my attitude on life changed for the better? Better means towards peace, equanimity, and calm. And if the answer is yes, then both you and the teaching are doing their job.
Yes, thank you. I get that. It's sometimes gets challenging, but yes, there is a reflection that I go through. And it is hard to admit I failed sometimes whenever I see that, but yes.
But the beauty of it, Shabnam, is it takes me back to the start of this talk. The association, you see, it is already, you're thinking about it all the time. So that is the most beautiful association. And why does this happen? Because deep down, you know that I am looking for peace of mind. I am tasting it. And so I'm thinking about all these spiritual teachings, these teachers all the time, because now that is my priority. So it's actually a beautiful thing, because reflection shows that inner yearning to go home is now so deep that you are thinking about it all the time. So that's actually quite a beautiful space to be, despite feeling that the progress is not enough, or we are not changing enough, or we are still reacting. That all will happen. Let's not focus on that. If you feel grateful to God, grateful to the source, grateful to whoever, that thanks to this, I'm in a better space now. That is all. That is the whole purpose of these teachings. Okay? Okay, I think we'll end this now. We'll sit in silence. And I do get some messages about some people wishing to have meditations more. We had it once, I think, a silent sitting. So it could be perhaps that maybe in some time we will have more of that, or just contemplations where we don't take questions and answers, but I might just choose a topic to speak on, and that will be interspersed with silence. And maybe let's see what happens. And sometimes questions are most welcome, because everyone learns from other people's questions, because after all, we all have the same issues in different aspects. And that is why Rameshji would encourage people asking questions, because for everyone's benefit was the answer given. That is the beauty of satsang. You may feel it is only your question and your answer, but that question you have asked on behalf of everyone. And the answer is given on behalf of everyone. That is the value of satsang. That is the value of group meditation. Group meditation, sitting in a group in silence, amplifies the meditation, because we are all connected. Group meditation was stressed upon in a big way traditionally in India. Silent sitting. All right. I'll just change the screen so I can see all of y'all.